So these are some of the stories that I think you should probably know about today. The U.S. finally has a politician who's equally despised by Democrats and Republicans, but seemingly beloved by average Americans. That's weird, huh? So who is this guy? And what did he do last night? I'm going to tell you. India has actually been importing more oil from Russia than it was before the most recent sanctions. What's up with that? Colonel Doug McGregor comments on this, as well as the latest in Ukraine. And Israel is prosecuting a major general. Her crime? She reported IDF soldiers who raped and tortured Palestinian detainees. And there's video. All this on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're going to begin with a new era in America. There's two stories today, interestingly enough, that intersect that we could very well characterize as out with the old and in with the new. Let's start with the old. This is U.S. President Dick Cheney. He died yesterday. And yes, I meant to say that. I meant to say U.S. President Dick Cheney. Let's not kid ourselves, okay? He had VP in front of his name, but he was a big P all the way. He called the shots, not W. Dick Cheney was like no other president before him. He was the king of the neocons. They put him there. And you know, we often talk about how U.S. presidents are controlled by the neocons, the Zionists and the war profiteers. We see that going on right now with what's going on with President Trump. Well, with Cheney, they didn't have to do that. They didn't even have to go visit him. They didn't even have to try and control him. He was quite literally one of them. And that's why everything he did was for them. Everything he did was for Israel. Everything he did was for big banks and for the people who make money off of war, like, oh, Halliburton, where he was the CEO before he became president, vice president. And by the way, this is important. You notice what's missing in that equation, in that list that I just gave you of the people he was helping? Americans. Ask yourself, seriously. What did Dick Cheney do for average Americans? Goose egg. Nothing. Niet. Nada. Why? Because that's not who he was put there to serve. It's not. Okay, so Dick Cheney's out. Who's in? Let's talk about this guy, Zoran Mandani. All over the news last night. He's 34 years old, a Muslim, who's the antithesis of Dick Cheney. He's the new mayor of New York and a rising star, I guess, in American politics, despite being hated, derided, attacked by the president of the United States, the entire Republican Party, and almost the entire Democratic Party. So who is this guy? Well, here he is, delivering his victory speech last night.
My friends, we have toppled a political dynasty. I wish Andrew Cuomo only the best in private life. But let tonight be the final time I utter his name as we turn the page on a politics that abandons the many and answers only to the few.
Billions of dollars were spent attacking this guy, Zoran Mandani. Much of it came directly from Israel, by the way. He's called a terrorist. Every day, an anti-Semite. Every day, and a communist. But he won the backing of the people all over the country, including Jews, young Jews, who supported him en masse. So how'd this guy do this? He did it doing something most U.S. politicians, interestingly enough, don't do anymore. He actually focused, not bullcrap, he actually focused his campaign, not on Israel, not on Ukraine, not on Iran, not on China, not on Russia, not on Venezuela, not on cultural wedge issues like transphobia, Christmas trees, and stuff like that. No, no, no. He focused his campaign every single day on the economic needs of average Americans. Weird, huh? When was the last time you saw that? That's what he did. And that's why none of those accusations against him, which were horrible, vicious, None of them stuck. People didn't care about that other stuff. All right, let's move on to Ukraine. The news there is continuing to break, and the pattern seems pretty much the same. Like it or not, the Russians are right now dominating the battlefield and appear to be on the verge of taking the key city of Pokrovsk. By the way, here's the headline from a respected yet generally pro-Ukraine Institute for the Study of War, which I've been reading for years now. They write, quote, Russian forces continue to advance in the Pokrovsk direction and appear to be operating with increasing comfort within Pokrovsk itself. And here's a map of the battle where you can see Pokrovsk is basically right now engulfed by the Russian army. And what they write about this is kind of in military speak, but I'll try and decipher it for you. What the article says is that geolocated footage published on November 3rd indicates that elements of the Russian 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade and others like the 51st Combined Army units are not only in Pokrovsk, but they also have captured Mirnorod. You see it right there just to the east of Pokrovsk. That's huge. And Rodinsky, you see that one right there just to the north of Pokrovsk, looking straight up. And that's important as well. So, look, the reason I'm showing you this, and I'm trying to show it to you from a respected Western source that follows this kind of stuff, is the story is pretty clear. Ukrainian troops are surrounded. Russians are about to take or liberate, whichever term you want to use, Pokrovsk, right? And it gets worse. Because as we first reported here with these videos that we got yesterday, Ukraine sent in Black Hawk helicopters to try some type of desperation rescue, but the helicopters were all shot down and the special forces troops that they transported were then systematically taken out by drones. Look at this. Look at this video. These are the soldiers being taken out one by one by these drones as they're trying to, I don't know, move into that area. It's the video, once again, you're watching as it happens. You see each of the soldiers come into frame, and then they're killed by the UAVs. So again, look, story's clear. Russian army's advancing. They're on the brink of taking the most important Ukrainian outpost in the war. And the latest attempt by Mr. Zelensky's government to alter the situation on the ground or maybe just deflect attention, as Glenn Deason told us here yesterday, away from the bad news, failed. The helicopters were shot down. So with all that, what do you think is the real story here? If you're the writer, if you're a journalist and you're writing this story, what would be your headline, right? Well, I'm going to show you something. Here's the headline the BBC went with. You can't make this up. Zelensky visits the troops near the embattled front line of Pokrovsk. I mean, can you believe this? Instead of telling essentially the truth of what's happening in the war, good, bad, or indifferent, which they eventually do, by the way, but you got to go about 18 paragraphs down to read what's actually happening in the body of the story, they turn it into a story about Zelensky. It's kind of like a PR stunt. The type of thing that real journalists are warned against not doing or buying into because it's so obvious, but they do it anyway. That's the BBC. Because they probably know that 80% of the people who will see that story, and this is a real study that's been done on this, 80% of the people who see stories like this, whether in social media or in newspapers, will not read the story. They will only read the headline. They will not read the real story. They will not find out about how Ukraine is losing the war. And for the BBC, you see, that means mission accomplished. Here's another interesting story, I think, as I was scouring the headlines this morning. It's another story you probably won't hear about in the BBC, by the way, unless it's written out of anger. Remember a few weeks ago when we reported here how this bad news had come in for the Russian economy, how the U.S. had placed more sanctions on two of the world's biggest oil companies in Russia? The idea was to stop countries like China, India, and others from being able to buy Russian oil, right? They wanted to punish Russia by hurting the Russian economy so that Russia, Mr. Putin, would then knuckle under to Ukraine. Well, apparently it's not working. In fact, take a look at this. Look at this story I found this morning. Since the announcement, India has actually imported more Russian oil. They went from importing 1.44 million barrels a day in September to 1.48 million barrels a day in October. they're not the only ones. Here's Colonel Doug McGregor explaining this to Tucker Carlson over the weekend, why the Trump administration's foreign policy, according to Doug McGregor, who's friends with the president, by the way, is just not working.
Everything is about theatrics and optics and appearances. And now we have the prime minister of Japan, who just made wonderful deals for Japan with us, by the way. Japan is going to continue to buy oil and gas from Russia. There will be no change in that. Japan is going to invest more in the United States. We're already heavily invested here as it is. That's not a big deal. Although Toyota has since come back and said, we're not increasing our investment. Sorry, we didn't make that promise. But she gave Donald Trump the most expensive set of golf clubs in world history. They're beautiful. They're magnificent. And she promised that she would nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize. And suddenly, President Trump says, this has been a big success. We are winning. So now he goes on to South Korea. I'm sure he'll get some similar treatment there. And oh, by the way, I see no evidence that India is going to stop buying oil and gas from Russia either.
All right, let's talk about Israel now, where the lawyer who revealed that IDF soldiers were raping and torturing Palestinian detainees has been praised by the Netanyahu government for her honesty and for her good character. No, of course, that did not happen. I kid. What actually happened is she is being arrested, and she's being placed under criminal investigation for misuse of information, breach of trust, and obstruction of justice, as well as disclosure of official documents. There you go. And what is her supposed crime? There she is, by the way. That's Major General Yifat Tomer. There you see her. She released video evidence of the Israeli soldiers torturing and raping the Palestinian detainees. They were caught dead to rights, by the way, and what they were seen doing to those detainees using batons. Man, it's just horrific. Here's some of the video. You'll notice that somewhere in this video, they try to disguise what they're doing using shields so nobody can see what they're doing. It's just disgusting. Again, I have to say, Israelis generally treat Palestinians worse than they treat animals. Because of the Major General's video, the courts were forced to now charge the men, though they didn't charge them with anything too serious, no rape charges. Instead, they charged them with aggravated abuse, whatever that means, and causing serious bodily harm. The whole thing is sick. Yet they have been defended by many hardliners, including members of the Netanyahu war cabinet. And that is why it's still quite possible that these IDF soldiers, though they've been charged, might end up walking away scot-free, while the woman who turned them in has already had to resign her post and is likely going to be prosecuted. I mean, damn. Another day, another travesty of justice in what's fast becoming one of the world's most hated governments. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He writes, he lectures about American society, politics, culture. I think he's probably one of the best journalists that America's ever had. He comes, like I do, from corporate media, because he's worked from the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor. He was a correspondent in Central America. And, of course, his real fame came when he was a reporter at the New York Times. Since then, he has gone rogue like the rest of us, and he's an independent journalist. He's out here in doing the work that he would not be allowed to do if he was working at one of those other places that I just named. And it is such a pleasure to have him back on. He and I got to know each other pretty well when I was doing this show out of Washington, D.C. Mr. Hedges, an honor to see you, sir.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me, Rick.
What do you think of this story coming out of Israel? I was pretty surprised to see that they're so outward, the Netanyahu government, in the way that they're treating this major general, as if she is the criminal here, when obviously I think what she did was the right thing.
Well, of course. I mean, that's why she did it. And she was under severe attack for these prosecutions. And she leaked the video to show that it wasn't fabricated, that the event had happened. But she's not alone. I mean, all sorts of dissidents. There was a high school teacher who posted on social media that they should stop the slaughter of children in Gaza. They threw him in jail. So Netanyahu's despotism is not limited to the Palestinians. It's anybody within Israel who carries out dissent or attempts to hold him to account. And of course, but this is perhaps one of the most egregious examples of that.
Do you think, I'm going to tie two stories together here, because we started off talking about the new mayor of New York. Do you think his election and the fact that, from what I've seen, young Jews in New York City, in particular, those I think under 35 years of age, voted in mass for this guy. Do you think that's related to this type of story that we just did that's taking place in Israel?
Yeah, I think Israel has exposed itself for what it is. And I was in the Middle East for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I'm an Arabic speaker. That's something that all of us who covered understood. But Israel's Hasbro propaganda campaign was quite effective. And of course, its allies in both parties shut down any kind of criticism of Israel. But the last 2 years of this live streamed genocide have essentially ripped the mask off of Israel. It's not that what Israel is doing is new, although it's doing it, of course, in places like Gaza with much greater intensity. And yes, it's alienated. I mean, 75% of registered Democratic Party voters during the last presidential election supported an arms embargo against Israel. And Kamala Harris, who on that issue could have won three swing states, according to the polls, ignored them because the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, is owned by the Israel lobby. And you and I come out of the media. We know the deep tentacles they have within the media itself.
Yeah, but you were one of the first persons to do this. I mean, and you remained courageous all throughout. You know, people are now giving Tucker Carlson a lot of credit, and he deserves a lot of credit, and so do a lot of other people out there who are podcasters, et cetera, because they're basically coming out, mostly guys from the right, interestingly enough. But no, there's Cenk Uygur and others as well who are on the left side, and they're doing the same thing. But you were doing this a long time ago. I imagine you welcome all these people who've now joined your ranks.
Yeah, well, you're right. It was a very lonely position. I mean, it goes back 20 years, I spent significant amounts of time in the occupied territories, and especially in Gaza, where I lived for months on end. But yes, it was a very lonely position. The Israel lobby, there weren't a lot of us. We were targeted. I mean, just event after event. I mean, for instance, being invited to speak at a university through my lecture agent, and then having that, they would use the Hillel House. This is the kind of houses on campuses that for Jewish life, but they've all been taken over by the main Israel lobby, which is AIPAC. Then they would carry these vicious campaigns against me, claiming that I was an anti-Semite and I would be disinvited. It's been a long and lonely battle, but I don't think Israel has any cachet left. And that's why you're seeing the more draconian forms of control. What is that? Criminalizing any kind of dissent. Of course, they shut down all of the encampments and protests on universities across the country, essentially ending free speech. They've become academic gulags, and you've seen powerful billionaires like Larry Ellison, who off and on is one of the richest people in the United States, buy up CBS and appoint an arch-Zionist, Barry Weiss, as the news director. He's poised to buy the parent company of CNN and HBO and TikTok. Because they don't have an answer left. It's really censorship and complete media control. And that speaks to the point that you just made. And that is that within the population, especially within the young, and that is across the political divide, Republicans, Democrats, however people identify themselves, which is why people like Marjorie Taylor Greene have been able to speak up on this issue. That has really changed. And then bringing up Mamdani, his main opponent, Andrew Cuomo, who had been the former governor of New York and left in disgrace over sexual assault allegations, he hammered it. It didn't work. It just didn't play with New Yorkers at all on the on Mamdani being a Hamas supporter and a supporter of terrorists and anti-Semite, et cetera. Mamdani's Muslim, of course.
You know, it's almost like they're saying the quiet part out loud these days. You know, I guess I am Rick Sanchez, so it feels weird to say this, but I remember there was once a guy on CNN named Rick Sanchez who was fired outright and called an anti-Semite for saying that too many Zionists were controlling the media in the United States. And now it's pretty obvious that Zionists are controlling the media in the United States and buying up everything they possibly can in social media now as well. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu bragged about it in a speech just a month ago.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, you made the mistake of speaking a truth that can't be spoken. And I, very frustrated with the coverage that the New York Times made of Gaza, because the way they neutered my reporting was, even though I was on the ground, every other paragraph would be the IDF spokesperson, or they would run stories out of the Jerusalem Bureau or the Washington Bureau that just directly contradicted what I was reporting on the ground. I wasn't interviewing powerful figures. I was in refugee camps that were being bombed by Israeli jets. The power of the Israel lobby was such that I used it influencing my own coverage, that I took a vacation, lived in a refugee camp, Han Yunus, published something called a Gaza Diary, which just day by day tracked what life was like. For I didn't interview any senior Palestinian officials or Israel. I just interviewed normal people living in a refugee camp over a 10-day period. It ended up being printed in Harper's Magazine. And the response of the New York Times was, you will never report from the Middle East again. So it's been a long battle. But I think on that issue of exposing Israel for what it is, I think that's a battle, unfortunately, at the cost, horrendous suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, where, you know, the situation has become almost untenable. I don't think there's any going back from that.
Interesting. Not going back. I'm trying to get a grip on this as well. I'm far away now, obviously, and becoming a much smarter person for doing so. You always used to share your stories about when you were a bureau chief, how much you learned about the world. I've probably learned more in the last 5 or 6 months traveling through China and the Middle East and Russia than I ever even imagined I would know in my life. So I'm really enriched in that way. But I'm really surprised by what I'm hearing about what's happening in my country. In the past, people would never say the things that they're saying, and they would fear the retribution of being called a communist or being called an anti-Semite or being called a whatever. And it seems like there's an awakening going on somewhere in America, and it's coming not from the left or not from the right, but from both. I'm kind of seeing this thing mustering up. What is your take on that? Am I wrong? By the way, you're there. You've got your finger on the pulse of things as well as anybody.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. But the ruling class, the two-party duopoly, which is corporate indentured and billionaire run, is utterly, not only tone-deaf, but as you pointed out in your monologue, hostile. And Mamdani is in for it now. The Democratic Party doesn't function as a viable political party. Its base has absolutely no say. As I mentioned earlier, you had the vast majority wanting an arms embargo. They want Medicare for all. This is kind of universal health care, et cetera, et cetera. And it makes no difference. And so what we have is a party that's utterly ineffectual as Trump creates an increasingly authoritarian system, because the mechanisms by which you could thwart Trump's consolidation of power, what is that? Mass mobilization, strikes, not loading weapons at ports that are destined to sustain a genocide, et cetera, are not embraced by the Democratic Party, because that mass mobilization, that re-empowering of people, and we saw effective movements, not just the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, all sorts of American Indian movement, Black Panthers, all these groups that rose in the 1960s and then were systematically persecuted and shut down, that re-empowering of the population would sweep away the Democratic Party hierarchy. Figures like Schumer and Pelosi who are highly unpopular. And so while the Democrats warn about Trump's consolidation of power and trampling of constitutional rights, et cetera, they won't embrace the only effective mechanism which could stop it, because they would be swept aside as well. And I just wrote a column on my Substack called, you know, Trump's Greatest Allies of the Democratic Party. So you're right that the mood in the country, I mean, and it's a kind of disgust with the entire system, with both political parties. The Washington Post just ran a poll. I think Trump's approval or the 63% of the population disapproves of Trump. But I think it's 68% disapprove of the Democrats.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mentioned how much I've been traveling and talking to different people, and I thought I would never say this. As you know, I was born in Cuba. I know your history as you know mine. And I grew up in Miami, so I'm kind of one of those anti-comunista guys and was always told that everything about America is fantastic and we're the greatest country in the world and our system is extremely democratic, while other countries are lackluster in that regard. But since I've been traveling around this part of the world, talking in China, for example, I talked to lots of Chinese intellectuals, many of which work for Morgan Stanley and stuff, and I asked them to explain to me, how can you call what you guys have is democracy if you're communist party, for example, and you don't have real freedom of speech. And they took me through their explanation. And in many ways, when they were done, Chris, I really got a sense of some of the things that I've started to see in my own country, our country. And that is, maybe our system is not that. We call it a democracy, but is it a democracy when the president is changed every 4 years, but they don't change because they're owned by the same power structure? And now I've talked to people in Europe and they say the same thing happens to them in the UK and in other places. And do we really have freedom of speech in the United States as we go around bragging that we do? The people in China tell me they feel more free than we do, and that they feel more democratic, or that they have more of a democracy than we do. And I'm not here to, you know, carry water for the Chinese or the Russians or anybody, but I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that maybe we ain't all the things that we say we are.
No, it's a failed system. I mean, that's what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin called inverted totalitarianism. What did he mean by that? It is that we keep the same iconography, language, you know, deification or sanctification of the Constitution, but all of those rights have been taken from us. The right to privacy, corporate money, the Supreme Court through Citizens United, flood our election process so the billionaires control the elections, along with powerful lobby groups, not just AIPAC and the Israel lobby, but the pharmaceutical industry, et cetera, et cetera. And the demos, or the people, have absolutely no say at all. And that is that deforming of the political system brought us a figure like Trump, or the Republican Party, which also doesn't function as a viable party, but it functions as a cult. There's a cultish quality. And I think you have to understand Trump as a cult leader, not as a political leader, to begin to grasp what's happening. And in a cult, those who are disempowered, remember, 30 plus million Americans lost their jobs in mass layoffs because of deindustrialization in the 1970s, in the 1980s. Clinton passes NAFTA, which another further 1 million workers lose their jobs. How do you expect them to react? Betrayed by the Democratic Party, the Republican Party doesn't represent their interests. And now you have a figure who claims that by, and this is what cult leaders do, by empowering him as a person, you become empowered. And also it's vindictive. I mean, Trump now has said that he's going to cut federal funds to Mamdani, has called him a communist. The billionaire class, which, as you correctly pointed out, put millions into Cuomo's campaign, are not done. It's, you know, go back and look at what the CIA did to Salvador Allende in Chile. These people play dirty. Mamdani's in for a very, very rough ride because he threatens their hegemony, the hegemony of the billionaire class and the corporate class that has captured our democracy, captured our systems of information, captured our universities. Let's not, be clear that all of the capitulation by a university, Columbia University in New York, to Trump's demands, which is, you know, putting the Middle East department under receivership and firing professors who spoke out calling police onto the campus, expelling not just students, but faculty. That wasn't just from the outside. That was on the trustee board. All those billionaires who were a kind of, fifth column within the university who want the same thing. So that's what we're up against. That's what Mamdani's election is an expression of, as was Bernie Sanders' campaign. But how, Bernie Sanders was blocked from the Democratic nomination by the Democratic Party hierarchy. And not just both Mamdani and Sanders ran campaigns based on small donations. If you took that corporate money out, Sanders would have won. Clinton wouldn't have won. And so that's what we're up against. And it's a huge divide. But though the ruling elites have no intention of giving up power, and they are using more and more draconian forms of control, some of which I mentioned, in order to retain that power, including ICE. Let's be clear with ICE. I mean, ICE, which has become a kind of, their master. I mean, I saw it in Chile when I was in Chile. We'd be at a demonstration. These unmarked cars would show up and these guys with their faces covered would jump out and grab someone in the crowd. And they disappeared. That's what's happening on the streets of American cities. And two people who are here legally, including U.S. citizens, and they're building massive, let's call them for what they are, concentration camps all around the United States. And if anyone thinks those centers of detention, where people are denied due process and everything else, are only for undocumented workers, they're extremely naive.
But here's the problem, though. You're right, and you pretty much illustrated what I had just mentioned about that maybe in our country we don't really have a true democracy anymore, because in true democracies, things can be evaluated and changed when they don't work. There is no process in America for changing things, not real things. They can change stupid things that don't really matter. But in the end, everything kind of stays the same because the people who are running the system are the ones who are going to be there forever and ever. And the politicians just come in and out, and they're basically bought and paid for like prostitutes.
Yeah, it's legalized bribery. But that's a good point. I mean, the system is calcified, and that's very dangerous. Because when there's no redress within the system, remember, America is an extremely violent country. We've had two assassination attempts against Trump. And mass shootings are so common it hardly makes the news. So the country is, and that's, I spent the last two decades writing books about it, Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, The Triumph of Spectacle, America, The Farewell Tour, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, because I saw that kind of calcification or within Yugoslavia that led to the war, which I covered. And so that seizing up, as you point out, of the American political system and economic system. 60% of Americans are living in pretty severe economic distress. That creates huge distortions culturally, socially, and politically. And that's where we are. And it's an extremely dangerous moment. The aspirations of, for instance, New Yorkers, the billionaire class, will stop at nothing to destroy Mamdani. And they have the economic power, along with Trump, to do it. And it's going to be very, very ugly.
So do you agree with me in what I mentioned in my monologue or alluded to the fact that his winning is almost weird? It's almost like a little bit miraculous that a guy like him, who doesn't represent any of those things that you and I have been talking about, just basically stuck to the issues and told people, I want to try and help you get better housing. I want to try and help you get better jobs. I want to help you find better schools for your children. Those are weird things to talk about in America because nobody talks about that crap. And if they do, it's
right.
Bull crap. I mean, it's not real.
Yeah, of course. They never talk about... Well, New York, as you know, first of all, it's the largest concentration of billionaires in the country. Adams, you have about 2.4 million New Yorkers live on subsidized rent. Adams has raised that by 12%. Costs are skyrocketing. The healthcare is a mess. You have a million people a year who have healthcare, who go bankrupt because they can't pay their bills. even if they have insurance. So Mamdani spoke to the real economic distress that is especially acute in New York with huge real estate prices. I mean, life is just the middle class in especially Manhattan almost doesn't exist. It's been completely eviscerated and people are hanging on by their fingertips. And he was very smart to remain focused. I mean, his proposals weren't even that radical. We were talking about, the richest country in the world. You get free bus. You can ride on a bus for free and you get free childcare. And maybe they can set up some groceries where you're not gouged. We're not talking about Lenin or something, although that's the way they want to paint him. I mean, it's pretty basic, bread and butter issues.
These are the things that when I talk to people around the world, they get freaked out by when I tell them, because every country, Israel, I think women get 18 weeks if they have a child off, guaranteed by the government. Every worker gets at least a 3-week, 4-week, or 5-week vacation. I'm talking China. I'm talking Russia. I'm talking Ukraine. I'm talking Israel. I'm talking most of the countries in this part of the world. Everybody gets some kind of health insurance where if something happens to them or if they just need to go to their doctor, they can go for free, right? So people ask me, wow, what's it like to live in America? And when I say, do you know how much they give women in America to when they get pregnant, when they have a child? Zero. Nothing. If your employer wants to give it to you, fine. Otherwise, you don't get it. As far as vacation time, again, it's up to your employer, whatever he wants to give you. As far as healthcare coverage, zero until you turn 65. That's kind of amazing, isn't it? I know it sounds, I mean, I'm talking to the choir. You know these things. But when you talk to people around the world, they go, no, that can't be. They don't believe me.
Yeah, there's a real cruelty to the American system because when you fall in America, nobody catches you. You fall all the way to the bottom. And it's, people die in this country because they can't afford adequate care. And the health situation is horrendous. I mean, lifespans are declining in the United States. So, it's an extremely, this is what unfettered, unregulated capitalism does. And the huge concentration of wealth, the creating a system where you funnel wealth upwards, that's essentially what we've done. And I can't remember the exact figures, but the top billionaires, Bezos and Musk and others, I think the figure's 600. They've increased their wealth in the last year, something by $600 million. I'm probably got it a little wrong. But that concentration of wealth is only getting worse and worse and worse.
You are, I've said this before, and I've said to anybody who's ever listened to me, and I've always said this whenever you guys have been together, you're kind of an amazing guy because you're kind of a hyper-intellectual in so many ways, a lot smarter than I am, obviously. And you've dedicated your entire life to just gathering new information, gathering news, essentially. You're a news gatherer. And then telling your stories. And it almost seems like no matter how much they try to knock you down, it's impossible to do it. What drives you, man?
I think anger. Because I spent so much time with oppressed communities, of course, 6 years in Latin America, all these poor people fleeing Honduras and El Salvador, the countries Guatemala, which I covered under Rios Montt, the countries we helped destroy. Actually, in Guatemala, Carter cut military aid in 77, and the people who stepped in to fill the void and carry out the genocide, 600 villages were destroyed in Guatemala, were the Israelis. And in fact, the Guatemalan army uses the Dalil. The Middle East, Gaza, when you build real relationships with people who are being oppressed and even killed by either allies or directly by your country, you can't not be hurt by it. You can't not be angry at those forces for distorting and often snuffing out lives you care about.
My father only had a fourth grade education, and he's the greatest man I've ever known. And he taught me, because he was a poor man, and I was poor when we first came from Cuba, and we had no money, obviously. We literally had, what we call refugee meat and refugee cheese that we ate every night. We call it in Spanish, carne refugio, refugee food. It's because of him that I think I think the way I do, and I don't think like an entitled person. I just don't, even though I can't complain. I've done pretty well for myself. Did you grow up poor?
No, I didn't. My mother was a professor. My father was a minister. So we were middle class. But my mother's family was poor from Maine. And they were working class. My mother was the only person from her family, our extended family, who went to college on a scholarship at the University of Maine. And that was kept me honest because I saw my grandfather never finished high school because he was gifted academically. But his sister's brother died and he had to drop out and work the farm because she had three kids. So I grew up around these people. And then I got a scholarship to boarding school. So I was with the uber rich, mediocrities, almost all of them. I would go back to the town where I'm from in Maine and just see that these people never had a chance. That in America, you know, if you're lucky, you only get one chance mm-hmm. if you're poor. And you may not even get that. So I think that kept me honest. They were all vets, by the way. They all were in the military. They didn't embrace, you know, they had some political opinions that, you know, made Trump look enlightened. But I love them to death. And I saw that, and they were, there was, you know, mills were big in Maine. They were all wiped out by NAFTA. The town where my grandparents are from, even the bank is boarded up. So I think that kept me rooted. I knew where I came from and I knew who I was loyal to, like you.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think now more than ever in the United States, you can tell who are the guys who fight for the little guys. And who are the guys who are only fighting for the big guys all the time? And I like what I see. I'm starting to see a lot of people on the right and on the left, you know? Doesn't matter. Parties don't seem to matter so much anymore. I'm seeing friends of mine who are, you know, I guess what we would call in the past right-wingers, and friends of mine who I guess in the past we would call left-wingers. I'm not sure those labels really stick or work anymore. But I'm seeing them kind of coming together and agreeing on many of the same things that you and I, for example, have been talking about. And I think that's a damn good trend, you know?
Yeah, because you're speaking about, this is what Bernie Sanders did. He spoke about reality.
Yeah.
You know, he spoke about an economic and political reality, which the mainstream politicians, even to this day, refuse to address. I think that was even a point that you made. And I think that a figure like Mamdani is important because he's addressing and seeking to redress those injustices. They will try and make his tenure as mayor, they will try and make New York City dysfunctional. Trump has already announced it, and they may be able to do it. I think you're right. I think that there is. And the people have seen through the system for what it is on both parties, and they desperately want something different.
And final point, you and I are engaged in trying to do as much we can outside of the conventional corporate establishment media. And there's also an upswell in that realm. I see it in podcasts. I see people's writings. I see a lot of independent thought that is getting probably more attention today than people, for example, on CNN or the New York Times, where you and I used to work. I was just looking at CNN's ratings the other day. They're doing like 150,000 people on their average show. That's tiny.
I mean, I get more than that on my Chris Hedges report.
Yes, I know. I watched.
I got last month at a show that was 2.5 million.
I mean, so that's good. What does it say? Do you think eventually there's enough alternative media or whatever the hell we want to call it to make a difference?
Yeah, I think the legacy media is bankrupt. I mean, that's why, again, the billionaire class and the corporations are going through algorithms and deplatforming, demonetizing. Every time I do a show on Gaza, it instantly gets demonetized. But the legacy media, they have exposed themselves as completely bankrupt. Look at the polls. So they have no credibility left. And that's why people are turning to sources of information where they know the people are not trying to spin them and lie to them and play them.
Chris, what a pleasure. So glad we had a chance to catch up once again.
Yeah, thanks,
I missed
Rick.
You, my friend. You're such a good guy.
Yeah, you're always fun to visit. We could speak Spanish. Nobody knew what we were talking about.
Podemos hacer esto en español. Imagínate, nadie lo va a saber. Exacto.
Okay.
Chris Hedges, great man. Hey, by the way, before I go, if people want to reach out to you, if people want to watch you, where do they go?
ChrisHedges.substack.com. That's got everything, the shows, the columns, everything.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Chris.
Great.
God bless.
Thanks,
say hello
Rick.
To your say hello to your wife
okay.
for me.
Thank you, Rick. Bye.
Take care. So thousands of you, by the way, have liked or commented our program yesterday about Black Hawk Down and the failed rescue and the Russian apparent dominion of Pokrovsk with Professor Glenn Deason, which was almost as good as this conversation I just had with Chris. AB writes, Dear Rick Sanchez, you raised an important point about Russia's non-response to Western actions, such as bombing, killing, and sabotage on Russian soil. I respectfully disagree with you, he says. The West aims to provoke reaction from Vladimir Putin and the Russian leadership. If Russia were to respond, it would provide the West with a convenient justification for its actions. Okay, point well made, sir. RC89 calls the Black Hawk rescue mission a one-wick I like this. A one-way helicopter trip. You got that right, RC. Gerald says, shameless British media still lying to the world that Ukraine is winning. You're right, Harold, and they're going to continue to do it. Amazing Balloon, what a great name, says, this whole war was promoted by Jewish neocon Americans because they wanted to get their hands on Russian mineral resources. Fascinating. B.S. Land says about our YouTube channel, journalistically speaking, that I was just talking to Chris about, YouTube is trying everything to minimize channels like yours. Otherwise, your channel would have already had 100,000 by now. Yeah, we're about to hit 60,000, so we're going to get there with or without them. Black Cat says, Rick, you said it perfectly. Europeans are stuck in the past. I am so grateful to your alternative guys being here for us people with common sense. Thank you, sir. And finally, Roger Rico says, God bless you, Mr. Gonzalez. You are the best, including McGregor and Scott Ritter and Judge Napolitano and many others. Gonzalez, huh? Well, it's Sanchez, by the way, but whatever. They both end in a Z. Thank you for watching and thank you for commenting. I'm Rick Gonzalez. By the way, I would love to hear more of your thoughts. So go over to our YouTube channel. It's called Journalistically Speaking. Let me know what you think. Rick Sanchez at X as well, or Rick Sanchez TV. We'll be looking for you there. Thanks so much for being with us. And we'll be looking for you next time.